Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's campaign rally on Saturday, where, instead of attending the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner, he fired up his base with attacks on the press in a dangerously divisive speech that essentially cast the majority of Americans who did not vote for him as the enemy. Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, joins us to discuss the GOP's drift from conservatism to nationalism under Trump and how he has segregated his alienated followers into an alternative universe in which his voters believe their leaders' lies while dismissing the mainstream media as fake news. Meanwhile, Trump courts the same mainstream media that he trashes, seeking their approval, if not their praise. Then we'll speak with Jody Freeman, the founding director of Harvard Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program and the co-author of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House, and we will discuss yesterday's marches to raise awareness of climate change and Trump's remarks yesterday about beautiful clean coal and his not-so-veiled threat to pull out of the Paris Accords. Then finally, with the latest GDP numbers showing this quarter's anemic economic growth of 0.7%, we will speak with Bernie Sanders' economic advisor, Stephanie Kelton, who served as chief economist on the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. She joins us to discuss Trump's one-page plan to make the American economy great again and her article in the Real World Economics Review, Can Trumponomics Extend the Recovery? And joining us now is Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. An award-winning scholar, teacher, and public servant, he is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy McCarthy.
Thanks, Ian.
Yesterday in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump made this extraordinary campaign speech. He obviously avoided the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner to talk to his people. And frankly, he does have a real connection with his base, it's clear. But it's also scary. It's frightening. If you watch the whole thing, the impression I had was that people who didn't vote for him are the enemy. And David Gergen, who served about five presidents, most of whom were Republicans, has said that he's the most divisive and dangerously divisive president we've ever had. How did it strike you?
Well, I agree with my colleague David Gergen that the speech was incredibly divisive, although this is not anything new from Donald Trump. I mean, his rise to political prominence and his election to the presidency was forged through a series of divisive actions and a whole panoply of divisive rhetoric. This is someone who is not at all interested in uniting America. He's absolutely committed to dividing America, and he's done that. That's probably the greatest success so far of his presidency.
Well, the division, though, that I find extraordinary is in how he has segregated his supporters into an alternative universe where they believe him, think he's honest and trustworthy. There's a recent Washington Post ABC News poll that says something like 89% of his supporters think he's honest and trustworthy, and 78% believe that the mainstream media propagates fake news. And that was very much the theme of yesterday's speech in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He railed against the failing New York Times and the so-called fake news. So I don't think we've seen anything like this since Joseph Goebbels or Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, a couple things in response to that, Ian. The first thing I would say is that, you know, Donald Trump's political style is to, on the one hand, bully anyone who gets in his way, anyone who offers a criticism, anyone who raises a tough question, anyone who would challenge his political power. That's one part of what he does. The other part of what he does is he seeks to marginalize and alienates those who are most vulnerable or most disagreeable with him. So ordinary people, whole groups of people, Mexicans, Muslims, gays, women, African-Americans, you name it. And that's sort of what he does. He bullies and he marginalizes. And this is that's at the core of his political practice. You know, I don't have a problem, per se, with a sitting president going to the people to engage directly with them in the places where they live. All presidents have done this to some extent. President Obama has done it. Other kinds of presidents have done it. Sometimes they do it with these big rallies. Sometimes they use the media to do it. But President Obama was very effective using social media and the internet. FDR used the radio through his fireside chats. John F. Kennedy and others used television for with Ronald Reagan used cable news. So it's not unprecedented for a president to use various media and various opportunities to talk directly to the people. The concern I have is not with that per se, but with what he says when he talks to the people. And that's what you're getting at, is the increasingly divisive rhetoric that we see from Donald Trump, the aggressive rhetoric, the authoritarian rhetoric of seeking to undermine institutions like the media, like the courts, even the legislatures and Congress. This is a man who is waging a full frontal assault on American institutions, on democratic institutions that serve to not only advocate for or to raise tough questions, but to try to preserve our democracy, and also institutions that try and check and balance the abuses of power that are always waiting in the wings and always lurking, right? We're a democratic culture, but we have authoritarian tendencies. But Donald Trump is the worst of those, I think, in recent political memory.
But what he does, though, while demonizing the press, he also courts the very same people that he demonizes, the New York Times. He is almost like an actor who's more interested in his reviews than his actual performance. He spends hours every day watching, for example, the press conferences that Sean Spicer conducts. And now he doesn't want to fire Spicer because he has high ratings. And that's the world that Trump inhabits, the idea of celebrity and ratings. So given the way that he plays this cynical game of demonizing the press to his base, at the same time courting them and trying to seduce them, why does the press go along with it? Why don't they boycott him?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. You know, Donald Trump manifests, and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I'll leave that to my colleagues at Yale and elsewhere who have deemed him problematic in those ways. But one of the things that I think Donald Trump consistently manifests is a kind of pathological paradox. On the one hand, he is someone who derisively and aggressively goes after what he calls the sort of lamestream media, the mainstream media, the failing New York Times, Washington Post, etc. And yet at the same time, he's a deeply insecure and narcissistic man who wants affirmative attention. He wants people to pay attention to him. He wants people to like him. He wants good ratings. He wants, you know, big, you know, rallies. And he's so insecurely obsessed with this with attention, and so he can't help himself. Simultaneously, while he's attacking the mainstream media, he's also courting them in a weird sort of way. One of the things that I was thinking about the other day, he must have been devastated when Tom Brady and so many of the other Patriots didn't show up at the White House. He must have been devastated when the side-by-side pictures of his inaugural attendance and Obama's inaugural attendance, more people showed up to march for women's lives and march for social justice the day after the election than showed up at his inauguration. And I'm sure that roils him at his core, because he is someone who, as I said, is narcissistically obsessed with affirmation, with being liked and being a celebrity. And so you see this operate over and over and over again, this way that he desperately needs that affirmation that plays itself out in all these ways. And yet at the same time, he attacks the very people who would give it to him. And so there's a certain kind of paradoxical dimension to his pathology, and we saw this in the campaign, we saw this in the lead up in the general election to the election itself, and we've seen it literally every single one of the 100 days since he's been in office, which to many of us feel like 100 years.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, and Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Well, there is a kind of Groundhog Day quality to this obsession he has about the crowds at his inauguration.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually, in the interview that he did the other day, with, I think it was the AP, actually, he had these printed maps about his great victory and all of this stuff. I mean, he keeps referring to his extraordinary Electoral College victory, which is certainly, less than average. I know you begged off the psychiatric or amateur psychiatrics, but have we ever had a president with such manifestly perhaps apparent mental instabilities, or at least, I think it's called extreme narcissism or chronic narcissism. I can't remember what the
I think one of the reasons why I'm so resistant to engaging in a kind of armchair psychoanalysis of Donald Trump is, one, I'm not qualified, and two, I think to label him mentally ill is an affront to those who struggle with mental illness and mental health in the country. And the last thing any of us need is to be lumped in with him. But to be more serious for a second, I think that anybody who reaches the point of being a viable candidate for the presidency, or someone who gets elected to the presidency, has a certain amount of narcissism flowing through them. We certainly have seen Bill Clinton had his own deep-seated desires to be liked and affirmed and so forth. There was certain narcissism there, even with, President Reagan and President Obama, President Bush, certainly President Nixon. I think Nixon is probably the closest comparison that we can make to Donald Trump, because we know now, with the distance of history and the careful scholarship that's been done on the era of Richard Nixon, that Nixon was incredibly insecure and unstable, and that he was full of anxiety and heard voices and all of these things. But the difference between even Nixon and Donald Trump, and certainly the other presidents since Nixon, Donald Trump, is while they may have a certain amount of narcissism that sort of fuels their desire to be the leader of the free world, they don't articulate themselves in public in quite the pathetic ways that Donald Trump, and pathological ways in which Donald Trump seems to love to do. That this is a person who is constantly talking about crowds and ratings and numbers and the people who love him. And he speaks in superlatives all the time, almost as a kind of linguistic projection of his own anxious desires to be talked about in those superlative terms. And the thing that I'm sure drives him crazy is the way in which that superlative discussion of Trump has taken on a quite negative turn, that he's the least productive president in the first 100 days in modern American politics, that he's the most divisive president that we've had in certainly in my lifetime, that he, when people talk about him in superlative ways, it's often very negative. And so that must drive him crazy. And so my feeling about that is that we need to keep doing it because, those of us who were always opposed to Trump as a candidate, and also to the Trump presidency and all that it represents, need to keep up the criticism. We need to keep up the dissent. We need to keep asking tough questions. We need to marshal and mobilize and sustain a resistance to the worst devils of our nation, which I think Donald Trump represents. If he's a leader of anything, he's a leader of what is worst about our country. There are a lot of great things about this country, including its radical devotion and practice to free speech and free press and free assembly and petition and so forth. And these are things, in an ironic way, that are fueling dissent right now, that are fueling a kind of democratic, critical questioning of his presidency, of him, and it's fueling the growing mobilizations that are taking place that we see all over the country week in and week out that really represent what is becoming of this movement moment. I mean, just yesterday, as we had the kind of chaos of a White House Correspondence Dinner without a president in attendance. The alternative, the not-so-formal or official White House Correspondence Dinner that Savannah B. broadcast, the rally that Trump had in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. We also had the march, the climate change march yesterday here in Washington, D.C., where hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets to call out climate change denialism that this presidency is trading in. We've seen marches literally, I think, every week since the inauguration itself, since the spectacular and unprecedented Women's March that took place this Saturday after his inauguration. So, you know, I think on the one hand, we can be scared and we can be even terrified with what comes out of his mouth and what we see unfolding in his presidency. But I also think that we need to be incredibly hopeful at this moment, that we have people who have awakened to a kind of resistance that I think is absolutely necessary in this time, and I'm proud to call myself part of it.
Well, I think, you know, I hesitate to give Trump credit, but I do believe he was very effective, more so than I think I've seen anybody. Like, you know, there's the old... Obviously, our politics have changed from a meritocracy where you vote for people who you think are the most competent to you vote for people who you think you'd like to have a beer with. But given George W. Bush and then Obama's performances and how much they engage their base, I've never seen anybody engage their base in a more effective way than the way Trump does, because he offers very simple solutions to complex problems, but he shares with them his presidency, you know, his decision making, you know, why he went on forever yesterday about why he no longer calls China a currency manipulator. I mean, it was ridiculous, frankly, but it was effective. It was very effective, I thought.
Yeah, no, it's no question. I mean, we have to take him seriously. I mean, that's one thing that I want to be very clear about, is I'm not one of those people who seeks to dismiss Donald Trump. He's the most powerful person in the United States, and he may very well be the most powerful or certainly impactful person in the world right now. And so I want to take him very seriously, not his ideas, but his power. And those are things that, and I think we need to make that distinction. I also think, you know, the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump spoke to something in the culture, and I think he spoke to three things. The first thing he spoke to was the widespread economic anxiety and economic paralysis that so many people are experiencing in this moment of incredible and growing economic inequality, and that's the legitimate part of what he's saying. The second thing that I think he's speaking to for some people, which is why so many small business owners and middle managers and people who still believe in the kind of myth of the American dream and the myth of meritocracy, he spoke to a kind of reality that the American dream is still alive and well, that it's still attainable for some people, that we can make America great again, that somehow America has been on the decline and he's going to bring us back to some mythical world of a great America where everybody, you know, worked hard and got ahead. And that, I think, is a little bit more problematic, but it still speaks to that economic anxiety and inequality that people are feeling and experiencing. The thing is, the most troubling piece of this is he articulates all of the fear and loathing and anxiety about others, about people of color, immigrants, undocumented people, women, LGBT people, people who are on the downside and have historically been on the downside of discrimination, but who have, because of a whole series of laws and opportunities, gotten ahead in some cases. And the people who are experiencing this, certainly the white working class, the fabled white working class that was so much a part of his days, are anxious about the fact that these others are somehow taking what they deserve, that this is the real violation of American meritocracy. The real denial of the American dream is that all these outsiders and others are taking what these people think that they are owed. And so that's the problem here. I would like to decouple the very legitimate appeal to an anxiety and inequality based on economics divisions and economic distance, and decouple it from the fear and loathing and anxiety that is rooted in the racism and the sexism and the homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia that is so much a central part of Trump's rhetoric, of his lexicon, of the way that he communicates with the world. That we can have a critique about economic inequality and how economic institutions are not serving everyone, how the American dream has been diminished over time, without being racist and xenophobic and discriminatory and prejudiced in all of these ways. These two things in a way are canceling themselves out. The illegitimacy of that prejudice is undermining our ability to have a legitimate and long overdue conversation about economic inequality in a country that has experienced a greater division, is currently experiencing a greater division between rich and poor, an accelerated increase in concentration of wealth at the top. The 1% has never been richer, and the rest of us have never been poorer, more anxious, more unequal, and more divided. And we have to get past the prejudice in order to get back to a place where we can ask tough questions so that we can move forward to progress.
But Timothy McCarthy, that's exactly what Bernie Sanders is trying to do now. He's trying to get the opposition to rally around income inequality and recognize that the economic issues are what is the glue that should tie the opposition together. But he's running up against identity politics.
Well, let me say a word about Senator Sanders and identity politics. The fact of the matter is that we don't have one type of inequality in America. We have inequalities in America. And one of the things that I think, one of the limitations, as much as I respect Senator Sanders and what he's done and what he continues to do, I think Bernie Sanders' analysis is limited because he plays into this false distinction and false choice between economic inequality or class-based politics and an identity-based politics of race, gender, sexuality, and et cetera. And we need to actually have an inequality politics that is based on an understanding that we experience inequality differently. Transgender people experience inequality differently than cisgender people. Black people and brown people experience inequality differently than white people do. Men experience inequality differently than women do. Gay people, but differently than straight folks. And we have to have a more sophisticated analysis, not the one that pits class against race, gender, and sexuality, but one that understands class through the different experiences of racialized people, of gendered people, of sexualized people. And until we get to that place, a more sophisticated analysis of how identities and inequalities converge and inform one another, then we're always going to be stuck, especially on the left, with this kind of false battle between class and everything else. And I think Bernie Sanders is limited in that way. And I think we need a new generation of politicians and policymakers, of activists and advocates who can bring a more sophisticated analysis of identity and of multiculturalism together with a more sophisticated analysis of the ways in which our economic institutions have failed so many of us.
Well, just in the last minute, I'd like to touch finally on the GOP and the direction it's heading in.
Sure.
A lot of analysts are saying, Timothy McCarthy, that the GOP is morphing from conservatism into nationalism, almost a bitter form of nationalism. What's your thoughts?
Yep. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing all over the world right now, it's not just in America, we're experiencing our own version of it. We see it in the UK with Brexit. We see it in France with the rise of Marine Le Pen. We see it all over all over Europe and in the West and the global North. We see this rising nationalism that is rooted in a kind of insecurity about nationalism. And that's the thing that's so interesting to me is that this nationalism seems to be speaking in a full throat or with a full throat precisely because it's so anxious, because global capitalism has created these inequalities, because migration, because of wars that have displaced people internally and externally from their home countries, that the migration and the inequality and all these things that we've been talking about have produced an anxious global moment. And the rise of nationalism, the attempt to wall ourselves off, to exclude people from our countries, to see ourselves as operating as a kind of party of one within a more complicated global environment and landscape is a problem. But the nationalism itself is rooted in an unstable foundation of prejudice and anxiety and inequality. And so we have to push through the tendency to close ranks and to close our borders and to close ourselves off to other people to get to a place where we see ourselves as more interconnected. We see ourselves as more able and willing to share our resources so that everyone can live lives of decency and dignity. I mean, if there's one thing that I think most human beings, if not all human beings, share, it's a desire to be free, to live a life of decency and dignity, and to be treated equally by other people and the laws and institutions that hold our societies together.
Well, Timothy McCarthy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
I do too, very much. Thank you. And I've been speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature and public policy and director of the Sexuality, Gender and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He is the author of The Radical Reader, a documentary history of the American radical tradition, and Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian.